Filippo, Miguel Noguera, and Paul Huckabee, our engineer. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Ariel Boone, Vesta Goddars, and Anthony Manzo. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Our website is democracynow.org. You can go over there for transcripts, video, and audio podcasts and sign up for our newsletter. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's 8 o'clock, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Thursday, July 20th at 5 p.m.
Have you seen KBOO's Fuzzy Boo Van? It's a giant furry blue Muppet mobile that brings music and joy wherever it's found in Portland and across the region. We're having a contest this summer. If you spot the van, post a picture on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the hashtag Fuzzy Boo, and you'll be entered to win a chance to have Fuzzy Boo at your event, as well as other prizes. Each picture you take is another chance to win. For more info and clues on where to find the van, go to kboo.fm/fuzzyboo.
Good morning. Welcome to Voices from the Edge. I am your host, Joanne Hardesty, and it is my absolute pleasure to speak with Angela J. Davis today. She is a professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law, where she teaches criminal law, criminal procedure, and criminal defense theory and practice. Professor Davis has been a visiting professor at George Washington University Law School and Georgetown University Law Center. She has served as an adjunct faculty at George Washington, Georgetown, and Harvard Law Schools. Professor Davis is the author of Arbitrary Justice, The Power of the American Prosecutor from 2007, and she's the editor of Policing the Black Man, Arrest, Prosecution, and Imprisonment, and co-editor of Trial Stories with Professor Michael E. Tigard. And the seventh edition of Basic Criminal Procedures with Professor Stephen Stolzberg and Daniel Capra. Professor Davis' other publications include articles and book chapters on prosecutorial discretion and racism in the criminal justice system. She received the Washington College of Law's Pauline Rowley Moore Award for scholarly contributions in the area of public law in 2000 and 2009, the American University Faculty Award for Outstanding Teaching, and a full-time appointment in 2002, the American University Faculty Award for Outstanding Scholarship in 2009, and the American University Scholar Teacher of the Year Award in 2015. Professor Davis' book, Arbitrary Justice, won the Association of American Publishers 2007 Professional and Scholarly Publishing Division Award for Excellence in the Law and Legal Studies Division. She was awarded a Soros Senior Justice Fellowship in 2004 and serves on the Board of Trustees of the Sentencing Project and the Southern Center for Human Rights. Professor Davis served as the Executive Director of the National Rainbow Coalition from 1994 to 95, and from 1991 to 1994, she was the Director of the Public Defender Service for the District of Columbia. She also served as Deputy Director from 1988 through 1991 and as a staff attorney at PDS from 1982 to 1988. Professor Davis is a former law clerk of the Honorable Theodore R. Newman of the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. She is a graduate of Howard University and Harvard Law School. Welcome to the program, Angela J. Davis.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. I just can't wait to just jump into this book. So you and I are going to talk today about Policing the Black Man. And you edited and did an introduction for this book. And it's a series of essays from scholars and legal experts around different components of how policing plays out, especially as it relates to Black men and our criminal justice system. Thank you so much for this work.
Thank you. It was just an opportunity I couldn't pass up because it's about an issue that I care so much about.
Oh, and I saw your dedication to the Black men in your life. I want to provide people with a couple of facts before you and I jump in. From your introduction, you say that African Americans are 2.5 times more likely to be arrested than whites, and 49% of Black men can expect to be arrested at least once by the age of 23, compared to 44% of Hispanic men and 38% of white men. I want to read one other quote before you and I jump in. You state, in fact, Black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than white men. Between 2010 and 2012, Black boys ages 15 through 19 were killed at a rate of 31.17 per million compared to 1.47 per million for white boys of the same age group. Those are some sobering facts that you start this book with, Angela.
Yes, and I mean, it's in the section of the introduction that I wrote, and just you mentioned before that I wrote the introduction and I edited the book.
Yes.
I also wrote one of the chapters in the book on prosecution because that's the issue that I focus on in my own scholarship. But in the introduction, I really thought it was important for me to talk about why we were doing this project, and specifically to talk about why we were focusing in on Black men and boys.
Right.
Because there are many other people who are discriminated against in our criminal justice system,
yes,
right? Black
yes.
women,
right.
Latina women, Latino men, Native Americans, other people of color,
right.
LGBTQ people, members of that community. All of them experience violence at the hands of the state, and all of them experience discriminatory treatment in the criminal justice system. But the experience of Black men and boys in the criminal justice system really is somewhat unique. And the most notable difference is that they are impacted more adversely than any other demographic in the United States at every age of the process, at every stage of the process. And those statistics you mentioned, among others that I outlined in the introduction, really point that out. That just in terms of sheer numbers, it's Black men and boys who get the worst treatment at every step of the process.
And your book really points out the fact that this has really been since the inception of what we know to be policing in America.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I mean, you pointed out there are a number of I reached out to who I consider to be some of the top scholars, lawyers, activists, advocates, agitators, I mean, the people out here who know this work and in many instances have lived this work.
Yes.
And one of those people is Brian Stevenson, who's the head of the Equal Justice Institute and the author of a wonderful book himself called Just Mercy, which I would definitely recommend to your listeners. And his chapter, the opening chapter of the book, really outlines how this really, you know, this treatment of black men, this started from slavery, right?
Yes.
From the arrival of the first slaves in Jamestown in 1619 to the lynchings of the 19th and 20th centuries on up to the present day. Black boys and men have been unlawfully killed by those who were sworn to uphold the law and by vigilantes who took the law into their own hands. And he really outlines this in such stark detail and beautifully written in the very first essay in the book.
Yes.
And just going to the history, because I think it's really important, I thought it was very important, to point out that this has been going on, you know, forever, you know, since we were first brought to this country. I mean, I think that most of the attention on this issue has really come really after Trayvon Martin was killed, right? Of course, not by a police officer, but by someone purporting to be a law enforcement person of sorts. You know, and at that point, the very important Black Lives Matter movement began, and I think with the, you know, with social media and our ability to now with cell phone cameras to videotape these things, that, you know, the attention really started to be paid. But it's important to understand this has been going on from the beginning of time, from slavery times to
yes.
Emmett Till, Medgar Evers. We, you know, but because we didn't have the video cameras, because we didn't have the ability to really prove it,
right.
No one ever believed, you know, what was going on. They took the officer's word that,
yes.
Oh, this person was reaching for a gun or they were armed. Now we can prove that that absolutely is not true. And the sad thing about it is, even when we are able to document these things,
I was about to go there, Angela. I was about
yeah.
to say, but even today, when we've got the video footage, when you've
right.
got community witnesses, when you've got the cell phone tapes, and when you still cannot convict police officers for killing unarmed black men, we clearly have a broken justice system.
Absolutely. I mean, there's, you know, it's so heartbreaking that we can actually, you know, witness these murders.
Yes. Right?
We saw Eric Garner being choked to death by
yes.
that police officer. We saw Walter Scott being shot in the
yes.
back. I teach criminal law. I know what murder is.
Yes.
And those were murders.
Right.
And, you know, it's just to have that happen, first of all, is so heartbreaking, and it makes us so angry and afraid and, you know, reaches to every emotion I can think of. But then to have these police officers, in most instances, not even charged
yes.
in the first place.
That's right.
But even when charged, to have a jury come back and say not guilty. When
right.
Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma was, we saw him on two video cameras, right? From
yes.
the helicopter
That's
and
right.
the dash cam. We saw him with his hands in the air,
yes.
clearly not attacking anyone and retreating and having that police officer, Betty Shelby, you know, murder him, really,
right,
in
right.
my opinion.
Right.
And she was found not guilty. So it's
But it is
it's
a
difficult.
Get out of it's a get out of jail free card when
yeah.
you articulate fear of a black man in the performance of your duty as a police officer.
Yeah, I so well put, and that's one of the issues we talk about in this book. Catherine Russell Brown, who runs the Center on Race and the Law at the University of Florida, has a chapter about implicit bias.
Yes,
right?
yes. About, oh, I did want to talk about that a little bit,
okay.
yes.
Sure. And she explains it so well. You know, these
yes.
unconscious views that so many people have, everybody really suffers from implicit bias.
Yes.
But when police officers and other criminal justice officials suffer from it, and they have the power that they do, it really has literally deadly consequences. So you pointed, I think you made the point quite well just then, is that when they see black men, you know, they automatically see criminal, no matter what they're doing.
Yes.
And Professor Russell Brown points out in her chapter all these studies that were done of these police officers where they were, you know, shown these images on a screen.
Right.
And then were, you know, asked whether they would shoot or not shoot, they tended to shoot more at unarmed black men than at clearly armed white men. That was just their gut reaction.
That's right.
As a result of this implicit bias. It's a very serious problem.
So Angela,
in general, but certainly with police officers.
Angela, let me read this quote. So the National Institute of Justice confirms that It confirms the conclusion that implicit bias and not overt racism drives many racially disparate policing outcomes. The researchers documented 174 incidents. So the researchers went on 132 tours with police officers, and the researchers documented 174 incidents where these officers became suspicious of an individual during their tour. Black men accounted for 71% of the instances where police officers identified an individual as worthy of suspicion. But in each instance, individual officers maintained that race was not the basis for their suspicion. Instead, officers reported targeting individuals for greater scrutiny because of the person's behavior or appearance. That is a very telling paragraph in this book about how implicit bias plays out in the day-to-day life of a police officer. So if you're assuming criminality based on race, then it appears that anything that a person, whether it's the manner of dress, the manner of walking, the manner of talking, could become an opportunity for police to intensify and become more aggressive in their interaction.
Absolutely. I mean, and that passage that you just read, I mean, really, really lays it out there. I mean, if you think about it, it's pretty frightening. It's just the very existence of our blackness creates in the minds of these police officers danger, right? And if you think about, you know, as we raise our young black boys and you know, to become black men, and Kristen Henning's chapter, Boys to Men, is just an incredible, you know, explication of this whole phenomenon of how even black boys actually are targeted by police more than black men.
Yes.
And it socializes both those boys and the police officers and the way they behave and interact with each other, and just goes on until they're adults. And it's just quite a frightening phenomenon. But this whole idea of implicit bias, I mean, of course you ask any of these police officers and they'll say, oh no, I'm not racist. Of course I don't see color.
Right.
It's because it's unconscious. They're not even aware
that
they are actually seeing a black person as a dangerous person because of the color of their skin. They're not aware of it. It's unconscious. But it's very real, and that's what's going on here. And the thing that's so difficult about that is that the law doesn't really provide a remedy for that kind of discrimination. The law requires...
I was just going to ask you about that, mm-hmm. because apparently, I mean, there used to be a time when there was discriminatory practices by government officials. The United States Supreme Court would intervene and correct that inequality. But it appears that the Supreme Court has reaffirmed police officers' rights to kill people at will with no accountability.
Well, and it's because in the criminal law especially, the Supreme Court has required proof of intentional discrimination.
Yes.
Right? You have to prove that the police officer or the prosecutor or whoever the governmental official might be, that they intended to discriminate against a person because of their race. And that's very, very difficult to prove. I think about it used to be that if you just showed discriminatory impact or effect, if you showed statistics to show that this number of African Americans were being were being treated differently, that was enough. But no longer. You have to prove not only the discriminatory impact or effect, you have to prove the intent, and that is nearly impossible to do.
Which Stop and Frisk in New York was a good example of mm-hmm. why that practice lasted so long, until some brave police officers actually recorded their instructions at roll call that actually mandated they go out and stop black and brown people for enhanced policing.
That case, and I'm so glad you brought it up, it's the Floyd case, Floyd versus New York, is really a groundbreaking case, because it was really the first time that I'm aware of that the Center for Constitutional Rights, the organization that brought the lawsuit, the first time that this kind of proof was able to, cause a success in the courts. And because, as you say, you had them sort of undercover recording,
yes,
you know, these conversations where they were basically told, go out and find black and brown folks and stop them on the street. And
right,
so you had a judge who found that they, in fact, had been using the stop and frisk practice in an unconstitutional way, that they were not using, that they were basically doing it based on race. But that is why it's so difficult to prove. You have to have a situation like that where you've,
yes,
got people basically saying that they intend to discriminate based on race. And it's rare,
right,
that you're going to be able to capture that kind of evidence. And quite frankly, I think that's not even what's always going on.
Right.
A lot of times it is the unconscious bias. And
right,
the court provides no remedy for unconscious discrimination. And that's the problem, is when you have so much of that unconscious racism, that implicit bias going on, and there's no legal remedy for it,
right,
then where does that leave us?
Especially,
and I think where it leaves us is that we can't rely on the courts.
Yes.
Sherilyn Ifill, who is the director counsel of the NAACP Legal and Educational Fund, co-authored one of the essays in the book with Jen He Lee, who's one of the staff attorneys at LDF, called Do Black Lives Matter to the Courts? Brilliant essay, wonderful title,
yes,
where they really explain that particular issue in ways that everybody, you know, you don't, that's the thing about this book that I worked on so hard with all of my contributing authors, that we're going to write this thing in a way that not just lawyers, but that your ordinary citizen, your ordinary person can pick up this book and read it. You know, the reader who's thoughtful can pick it up and understand it.
Yes.
And she, in that chapter, I think, explains so well how the court has, I won't say evolved, I'll say devolved.
Yes, yes.
In the way that it has been treating these cases, these race cases. And she explains that so well. So my thing is that, you know, if we can't, and that's not to say we give up on the courts, and
right,
certainly Ms. Ifill and the LDF is doing, they're doing phenomenal litigation, and, you know, they're really leading us when it comes to civil rights and their victories in the Supreme Court and other federal courts as well. So we don't give up on the courts. You have to sort of push the courts and
right,
try to get the law to change. But at the same time, we've got to look to other means to make these changes in the criminal justice system.
Oh, so I gotta get your legal advice on a situation that just happened here in the city of Portland. You might know that the city of Portland is under Department of Justice investigation for excessive force against people with mental health issues or perceived to have mental health issues. What you may not know is that the Department of Justice, in their negotiated settlement agreement, required police officers to, after the use of force, at the end of their shift, to do an after-action report that articulated what happened at that incident, right? That excessive force was used. So the community just found out about a week ago that the Department of Justice, the police department in the city of Portland, in collusion with our district attorney, has now tried to change the law that would prohibit police officers from writing a written report until after they have been cleared by the grand jury. And even though it doesn't say after they've been cleared, you and I know that officers are routinely cleared by the grand jury, mm-hmm, and they're not actually charged with criminal behavior for using excessive force or deadly force against unarmed community members. And so this is about to come in front of our city council, that we're going to change the police practices so that this becomes the law the land. I'm appalled, and I just want your opinion as someone who's been doing a lot of research around how you hold police accountable about how crazy this is.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite unfortunate. It really gets to the point that I was about to make in terms of what we need to do to remedy these problems. When the courts don't offer us a remedy, we
yes,
have to go elsewhere.
Yes.
And you know, you said this is going before the city council.
Yes.
People from the
yes,
community need to be at that hearing.
That's right.
Need to make their voices known.
Yes.
Because, you know, these are elected officials.
Yes.
You know, district attorneys are elected officials.
Yes.
City council people, mayors, they're all elected officials. And in most jurisdictions, the mayor is the one who appoints the police chief. So,
yes,
you know, they understand the vote, and they
yes,
understand the ballot box. And so we really have to make sure our folks get out and get involved and not just wait until, you know, the date. Of course, we got to go out and vote.
Right.
But before that time, you know, we can't wait every 4 years. You know, a
yes.
lot of bad things happen between elections.
Between elections, that's right.
We need to be out there. And it's hard. I mean, I you know, people have jobs.
Yes.
People are struggling. They oftentimes don't have the time or means to get out there and be active. But we really have to do our best to get out in our communities and get folks to come out, educate them about these issues,
yes.
and have them show up
yes.
and let these elected officials know that they are not happy with the actions that they're taking and that they're going to make, you know, their opinions known, not just that day, but on election day as well.
Absolutely right. So if you're just joining the conversation, I am speaking with Angela J. Davis. She is the editor and does an introduction for Policing the Black Man, a collection of scholarly documents written that make the case for how policing happens in the black community, especially with black men, radically different than any other demographic group in the United States of America. We have a caller on the line. Good morning, Steve. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning, Joanne. Love your program.
Thank you.
I'm impressed by your guest. I wanted to ask a question about the stop and frisk policy. And then I'm originally from Baltimore, but the homicide rates in Baltimore and Chicago are very alarming.
That's my hometown, too.
Right. Well, cool. Well, when you look at the policy, the stop and frisk policy in New York, it's often that's cited as a reason for the reduction in the homicide rates.
Right.
And I'm curious about how that's interpreted. And then, you know, personally, and I'm not educated on the subject, but my opinion is that, you know, if the NRA was consistent, they would have opposed stop and frisk.
Yes.
And if the Black Lives Matter movement was consistent, it would have demanded it in Chicago and Baltimore. And again, I'd appreciate whatever comments you have on again, that stop and frisk, New York's reduction in homicide in comparison to Chicago and Baltimore.
Thank you so much. Appreciate the call.
Thank you, Steve. And I really appreciate your question.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in fact, the research that was done in New York City showed that absolutely is not true, that
yes.
the stop and frisk policy was absolutely not stopping homicides or violent crimes. The New York Civil Liberties Union analyzed the New York Police Department's 2011 stop and frisk database, and they found that 41.6% of all stops were of black and Latino men between the ages of 14 and 24, even though they make up less than 5% of the entire population of New York. And that same study found that no crime had been committed in 90% of the stops. That's 90.
Whoa.
So there are even more stark statistics if you look at the opinion that Judge Scheinlin, when she found in favor of the plaintiffs in that Floyd case we were talking about earlier,
mm-hmm.
the statistics were even more stark. They were stopping all these black men and boys, and they were finding drugs or guns in like 1% of the cases.
Yes.
So, you know, the policy absolutely was not doing what it purported to do, and it was causing a great deal of harm
yes.
otherwise.
Well, you know, we
have a lot of people.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Angela.
Go ahead.
Oh,
no,
my
point is that I think, you know, a lot of people also are saying, you know, that Judge Scheinlin outlawed stop and frisk. She didn't outlaw stop and frisk. The Supreme Court has said in a case called Terry versus Ohio that police officers do have the right to stop and frisk people if they have what they call reasonable suspicion
right.
to believe that they're involved in crime.
Right.
So that's still the law, but what she found in the New York case was that that's not what they were doing. They didn't have reasonable suspicion
that's
at
right.
all. They had no suspicion. They just had black face, brown face,
right.
I'm going to stop them.
Right.
The problem with the stop and frisk policy is that it's so, the way the Supreme Court, getting back to, you know, our point earlier about the courts in the Supreme Court really does allow police officers to do so much legally that
yes.
unfortunately leads to a lot of black men and boys being killed. So that stop and frisk policy, it's so easy, that reasonable suspicion standard.
Right.
It's such a low standard that almost anything can justify a police officer stopping a person. And then once they stop them, the frisking process is
right.
really an awful, awful, violative type of process where they throw people on the ground, you know, spread their legs, touch them in ways, you know, many offensive ways on their bodies.
Right.
And, of course, that's going to cause
anger.
You know, especially anger, exactly.
Right.
Especially young boys who are adolescents. Of course, anyone, really.
That's right.
They're going to respond, as any human being would be, in a way that's not going to be, you know,
thank you so much.
Because
right.
they're being violated in
that's
such
right.
a way, and then things escalate.
Yes,
and then we have, you know, oftentimes just really horrible results. So it's really a difficult phenomenon.
And so I could certainly make that real for my Portland Metro listeners, because Portland Police Bureau's data hasn't changed in 20 years of record collection. When the gang enforcement unit, every year, they stop, 44% of their stops are African Americans in a city with a 7% African American population, in a state with a 1.3% African American population. But yet, 44% of the stops, so if you do the math, and if you believe gang membership happens between 12 and 24 years old, think about how many times you'd have to stop every 12 to 24-year-old black boy in the city of Portland before you got to 44% of your total stops. Mm. Right?
Awful and, statistics.
Right. Yeah. It is. But the thing that makes me crazy is that politicians look at those statistics and they don't see anything wrong with them.
Yeah. And that's either because they have a severe lack of understanding or a lack of empathy, or they just don't care. I don't know which one it is.
I don't either. But we got another caller on the line. Annalisa, welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. Professor Angela J. Davis, you have been a role model of mine since the late 60s, early 70s.
All right.
When I listened to you on the radio and followed some of your talks and lectures, and I was wondering whether you ever considered running for president of the United States.
Oh my goodness. Alright, first of all,
Angela for president, hey,
you and Lisa Hill, or remember when the Clinton administration first started and he tried to appoint he wanted to appoint a black woman to his cabinet and was forced to not do that. I admired her a great deal, but I would think things might drastically change if that happened.
Well, I mean, I agree with your point. I mean, I think that we have to change who's in elected office if we're going to get different outcomes, right?
Because I have no words for all the racism and discrimination, and I have had a few encounters, and I might have brought that up once several years ago while I was waiting on the Martin Luther King Boulevard in my car, waiting for somebody late at night, and a small group of very young people, barely teenagers, came dancing down the street. You know, they had been somewhere to an event. And they came to the corner of Russell and MLK, and all of a sudden, three or four police cars
show up. Right.
But and I watched it, and I was ready to get out of my car. But then, fortunately, two other cars showed up, and those were the parents.
Ah, nice.
Or at least, you know,
adults, community adults, right?
So they were just on their way, and people were going to pick them up. But that was so blatantly a sign of racism against these very, very young children.
Right.
Anyway,
well, Angela certainly made the point that just being black is enough to make you suspect.
Yeah.
And how our criminal injustice system currently works. So.
And again, with this latest, I don't know. I didn't follow it all the way because it's sometimes too much to listen to all this tragedy. But, and I don't even know if this was a black woman. I think her first name was Tina, just a week or so ago.
A white woman. Australian woman.
Oh, yeah, from Australia.
Yes.
She came out in her pyjamas, for Pete's sake.
Yes.
and they shot and killed her.
Well, now let's unpack that a bit, because here's what we haven't heard. We didn't see that woman's mugshot on the front page of the newspaper. We didn't hear that woman being described as someone who was troubled,
yes,
and suspect, right? What we heard in that case, which I have never heard before, even when the police officer killed Trayvon Martin, was an apology from the police officer immediately, mm-hmm, to say that they made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
There was no vilifying of this woman. There was no talking about what was she up to, why did she do what she did. There was no justification. Now contrast that to every time you've heard of a black man being killed by a police officer.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I can understand very clearly why she just came running out, because when you live in a country where like I am from the Netherlands, I would run out to the police too if there was something.
Now see, I wouldn't.
Because you don't expect them to be aggressive or violent.
Well, I do. I'm a 59-year-old black woman in the United States, so I would not.
Yeah, but when you're like from Australia,
right,
or from,
right. If you're from another country, you think they're there to help.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I appreciate your call. I want to make sure Angela, because we haven't given Angela a chance to comment.
No, I've been enjoying listening to the conversation. First, I want to thank Annalisa for her comments, but I also want to just be clear. Some of her comments make me think she might have me confused with Angela Yvonne Davis. And I'm not Angela Yvonne Davis. She's one of my sheroes.
All right.
So admire her, and she also has been doing a lot of work around the prison industrial complex and the criminal justice. And so
okay,
there's always a lot of confusion with people confusing.
Well, I know at first I thought you were the other Angela Davis,
yes,
right?
A lot of people make that mistake, but I tell you, I'm happy to be mistaken.
Right. There are worse comparisons, right?
Person. But I would never. She's talked about running for office. That Angela Davis actually did run on the Communist Party ticket years ago.
Right.
For president.
Yes,
and
I remember
good
that.
For her, but I definitely would never run for office, but I'm glad she raised the issue, because running for office is something that people in our community really need to consider doing.
Yes.
And in particular, one of the chapters you mentioned that I edited the book and wrote the introduction, I also wrote one of the essays in the book, and it's called The Prosecution of Black Men. And one of the things I stress constantly is that we need to have more prosecutors that are thinking progressively, and we need to have more people running for district attorney. And in the last election, I'm happy to say, 2016, there were a number of progressive people who ran for and won their elections, district attorney.
Yes.
Kim Fox in Chicago, just a phenomenal black woman who defeated Anita Alvarez, who was one of the worst prosecutors in this country in terms of engaging in misconduct. And she was the prosecutor who, again, had some involvement with one of these high-profile cases. A young black boy named Laquan McDonald was shot down and killed by police officers on the streets of Chicago. There was a videotape showing that the police officer was indeed liable. And Anita Alvarez sat on that video, didn't release it until a court ordered her to do so, and then that video showed what happened, and then she decided to charge. Well, she was defeated soundly.
Wonderful.
By Kim Fox, who has come into office, and even in the short time she's been there, has done tremendous work. Aramis Ayala, another black woman, elected the first state attorney for Orlando in Florida. Is doing great work, but is under fire now because she decided not to seat the death penalty. And the governor, Rick Scott, Republican governor, has now removed her from all of the cases in which the death penalty can be sought, and appointed a district attorney from another jurisdiction who was not even elected by the people of Orlando.
Whoa.
To take over all of the death penalty eligible cases. And Ms. Ayala is suing the governor.
Good
so
for
we
her.
Need to keep our eyes on that case, because she is suing, saying that the governor had no right. So there's a lot of interesting things going on. But yes,
Run for office and seriously consider running for your local state's attorney, district attorney, because they are the most powerful individuals in our criminal justice system. They make the decisions that really create these terrible outcomes, and we need to get good people in those positions so that we can start to make some changes in our criminal justice system.
And quite frankly, here in Oregon, it is rare to have a DA's race contested. In fact, in the largest county, Multnomah County, the district attorney, after 32 years in office that he took from his daddy, his hand-appointed replacement showed up on a special election ballot by himself and then was duly elected with no competition at all. So I do know we have the Oregon Criminal Resource Center who is actively advocating that we start making sure that no district attorney in the state of Oregon runs unchallenged. And
that's
I think that's where we start making the differences. Because you know what, I gotta tell you, Angela, nothing in your book is a surprise to me, right? And it's not a surprise because I've been reading police reports and studies and over the last 22 years on policing in the city of Portland. What surprises me is how the elected officials continue to be shocked when these reports come out that show how unequal our justice system is. For example, the Portland Tribune, in conjunction with an investigative reporting team, did a series of articles in February here in Oregon about the high cost of being black in Multnomah County. It showed that black people across the board pay about $2 million more per year in court fines than any other population, because apparently if you're black, the fine is twice as much as it would be if you are white or any other ethnic group. The charges are more severe across the board. The penalties are more severe. And it is the police officer on the street, it is the DA's office that makes the charging decision, and it is the judge that ultimately decides the sentencing. Across the board in our largest county in this state, the outcomes are horrific if you are black, and especially if you are black and male between 12 and 24 years old.
Wow, I thank you so much for all of that information. And I tell you, Joanne, what you just talked about, I'll start with the elections, about DAs running unopposed, that is a phenomenon that is nationwide, not just in Portland. In fact, one of the chapters, one of the essays in the book written by Ron Wright about the elections of prosecutors lays out all the statistics. He's done a lot of research on that issue. That's a problem. Most of them run unopposed. They serve for decades. People don't really understand what prosecutors do, so they are not really pushed to do anything but what they're used to doing all alone.
That's right.
And they run on these tough-on-crime, you know, I'm tough, and then if anybody ever opposes them, they say I'm tougher. They never talk about what they're doing behind closed doors. Those charging decisions and the plea bargaining decisions. And I'm really interested in hearing what you just said about the finding, about the fines being, that is exactly what was found in Ferguson.
Yes.
The Justice Department came in under Eric Holder, and they did that investigation.
Yes.
And they did a similar investigation in Baltimore, and it was the same finding that you found. All of this unconstitutional behavior by police officers, stopping black and brown people without any reasonable suspicion, giving them these tickets with these awful fines that they were unable to pay, and then, you know, jailing them when they weren't able to pay
them.
And so what came out of both Ferguson and Baltimore, these consent decrees where they had these agreements between the Justice Department and the police departments that the police departments will clean up their act, and if they don't clean up their act, then the Justice Department is going to bring charges. Well, now you see who we've got ahead of the Justice Department right now. You know, Sessions, who's trying to undo, you know,
Those consent decrees.
But, you know, so far he has not been successful. For example, in Baltimore, he tried to delay it, and that judge said, no, indeed, we are going forward with this consent decree.
Wonderful.
And, you know, and that's the thing we have to hold on to. There's a, you know, we have to hold on to the fact that there are judges out there, federal judges, many of them appointed by President Obama, who are doing their best to enforce the law and the way it's supposed to be
enforced.
And so far, they've not been able to undo them. But we know there are not going to be any more consent decrees long as Jeff Sessions is the head of the
Justice Department. Because the whole 8 years of Bush, there were zero investigations of police. Right.
Exactly.
So we've got a couple of callers on the line. Good morning, Francis. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Hi, I appreciate your conversation this morning. And they wonder why mamas have hypertension.
Right.
I have, in the communities that are targeted, having raised my young sons and both my sons and my daughter in Northeast Portland as it was being gentrified, it was very clear that our community was being targeted. And I wish some statistics were done on each individual child and how many times they've been stopped. I know my young son probably can count at least 15 times that he was stopped in his own community, the only neighborhood that he's ever lived in when he was a child. And I want to see some statistics on that because the comparison would be crazy.
No, I think you're right.
That's interesting. Thank you for your call and your point. I mean, that's actually what happened in New York in the case we've been talking about, that Floyd case. They did have, you know, a number of the plaintiffs to testify, meaning they picked several of the young men who were part of the class action to testify, and they did testify about the numbers of times that they were stopped in their own community for doing nothing.
Yeah, while they're developing and rejuvenating the community and gentrifying it, they're targeting the young people. Also, I agree with you that the DAs are culpable in a lot of this, and I'm glad that we're finally starting to look at that. You guys are, I'll just go ahead and listen to you, but I want to note and have good thoughts for O.J. Simpson. He's got a parole hearing in about an hour. And he may finally be free after 9 years.
Thank you for your call.
You guys take care.
You too. Really appreciate it. So, Angela, we are going to have about five more minutes because I actually have to do something at the end of the program for the last 10 minutes. So we're going to take one more caller, and I'm going to give you an opportunity to tell us what do we do from here. Okay?
Okay.
Hello, Mr. Barnett. Welcome to KBOO. Good morning.
Good morning. And first, a deep appreciation for Angela Davis. The other Angela Davis is on now.
Angela J. Davis. Thank you.
J. Okay, Angela J. Davis and you, because this is so important, and I really appreciate you doing it, and I agree and understand and have understood for a long time all of the things that are being discussed, but I have a important correction to make.
Okay.
You cannot please leave this show without addressing the fact that even though we know about implicit bias and what that does, and that actually everybody has implicit bias, but that cannot alleviate the fact that there are many of those death cases where police are killing black people are not from implicit bias. It's from conscious bias. You can't just erase all of it and let everybody off the hook and just say,
say it's not their fault. They don't know what they're...
No.
Yeah.
We do know that
they're racist. Yes.
That are conscious.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we've got our own Nazi police officer who our last police commissioner cleared his record. So if you didn't know that Nazi was a trainer for Portland Police Bureau, then you would know who is training recruits, right, in Portland training facility, right? So we have a Angela, for your information, we have an officer who liked to put a Nazi plaques up in public parks, and our last police commissioner cleared out his service record. So anybody who comes in after the last police commissioner won't know that this Nazi was actually held accountable at some point. But the last police commissioner decided that he was such a good police officer that he shouldn't have that stain on his record.
That's really outrageous.
Yeah, and that's how they protect each other. Thank you, Mr. Barnett. Appreciate the call, and I absolutely agree with you. I think that there's a lot more explicit bias than there is implicit bias, because quite frankly, there is no excuse for the targeting of black and brown men and boys if you don't assume that they have criminality just because they exist. If you didn't
I very much appreciate the caller's point. I'm not suggesting that all of it is implicit bias, for sure. In fact, I think in the case in Cincinnati, that police officer who killed Sam DuBose, who I think they had two hung juries and the prosecutor just decided not to try him a third time. I just heard yesterday that they found that he used to wear a Confederate flag T-shirt under his uniform. I mean, certainly not suggesting it's all implicit bias. Right. Just to be clear with the caller, even if it is implicit bias, that does not excuse the behavior. And I hope that he didn't think I was suggesting that.
Well, he knows me.
Implicit bias doesn't get anybody off the hook.
That's
for
right.
Sure.
He knows me, so he knew I wasn't suggesting that either, Angela. Well, Angela, I could talk to you all day. I hope you will bring your book tour to Portland, because we could get a lot of people to come out and have a conversation about this. This book will become as valuable, if not more, than the work that was done by our sister, Michelle Alexander. Once again, your book actually... is the same model, because all the research that you've done are all in the book. And when I first read Michelle's book, I was like, well, gee, she's got a lot of notations about where she got all this information. But I understand thoroughly why that is, because people will argue that this isn't true. People will argue that racism no longer exists. People will argue that police officers have a really hard job, and why are we trying to make their job harder? And so I thank you very much for this very detailed analytical look at where we are in policing, and it is my hope that once we know, we can actually fix our very broken criminal justice system.
Well, Joanne, thank you so much. This has been a wonderful conversation. I so appreciate you. I appreciate your callers, and thanks so much for having me.
It has been my pleasure, and I'll look forward to the next steps with this book. You have a fabulous day, Angela J. Davis, and I will put your book information on our Facebook page and on the Cable website. So
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And so I bet my callers are wondering, why did I end earlier? And so I have to share with you that today will be my last day on the air for about 8 months ish. And so I will be taking a leave of absence from KBOO. I've been doing this show for like 24, 5, 6 years. It is the hardest thing for me to do not to come in here every Thursday morning from 8 to 9 and share with you my perspective and my viewpoint. But don't worry, I will be back. And in my absence, you might wonder, well, what's going to be happening on Voices from the Edge for the next 8 months? You will be thrilled to know that there will be a variety of voices that will be coming through the KBOO studio, participating on Voices from the Edge. Those voices will reflect the diversity that really does exist in the city of Portland and throughout the Portland metro area. I have invited organizations like Poetic Justice, which will start being on the program in the month of August. I've invited APANO, which will be on in September. I've invited Unite Oregon and other groups who I know are doing really fabulous work in our community to take a month at a time and come on and tell you about the work they're doing, the people they're working with, the efforts that they're involved in, so that you can become more aware of all the great work that is taking place around the Portland metro area. And so I don't want you to think that I am abandoning KBOO. KBOO is in my heart and blood and soul. I will be back. And I want to make sure that the people that are coming on know I'll be back. So I'm just temporarily stepping away from this mic. You will be hearing soon about what my next adventure will be, but I want to assure you that it doesn't mean I'm going away. I will be back. I love this program. I love K-Boo, but I have to go away for a little while. And I want you to know I am healthy, so no medical emergency is taking me away. I don't want any rumor mills like saying I'm on my deathbed or anything. Knock on wood. I am still healthy. I am still able. But I just want to make sure that you know that I will be back, in fact. So any questions, you can always contact me on my Facebook page, or if you've got my email address, then you can do that as well. But I will still be accessible, still be around. You won't miss me that much. I will miss you, however. I will miss getting up at 6 o'clock on Thursday morning so that I'm here, so that I'm prepared, so that I'm ready to share with you the next best thing that I know about. So one more piece of activism before this show wraps up. It is my understanding that the city council is prepared to delegate contracting decisions at the city of Portland for contracts under $500,000. They will no longer be required to come in front of the city council for approval. I absolutely oppose this change because just a few weeks ago, I stopped the city council from voting on a $300,000 contract that the Portland Police Bureau tried to slip through the city council for a community engagement plan as part of the settlement agreement. Unfortunately, our elected leaders on the Portland City Council don't actually read what they're voting on at the City Council. So when the police comes and say, I have to pass this as an emergency measure because we need to spend the money this fiscal year versus next fiscal year, and they don't actually read the material they're voting on, we would have contracted with some firm to do a community engagement plan without the benefit of the next police chief, who, as I understand, has not been selected yet. There is still a process taking place that community members are interviewing the next police chief for the city of Portland. There are 6 finalists, and any of the other 5 would be fine with me that are currently up for review. So anyway, this contract should never, ever had been on the city council agenda. They should have never considered it. And so passing this measure tomorrow that would allow bureau folks to spend $500,000 without the council approval, to me, just actually sets us up for an abuse of expenditures at the expense of the taxpayers and the people of the city of Portland. If you're spending $500,000 of public money, I think the city council must weigh in. I don't think there's anybody within City Hall that should be making those decisions outside of the people elected by the people to represent them on the city council. And so that's my wine for this week. I would encourage you to actually go online, read the city, the agenda for the next city council meeting, and strongly oppose any effort to take out of the public eye the expenditure of $500,000 of taxpayers' money that the city council does not publicly vote yay or nay for. I want to be able to hold somebody accountable if that $1 million is that, if that $500,000 is misspent. And if the city council doesn't vote on it, guess what? They won't consider themselves responsible for it. And we, the public, should be weighing in on any of that. And since I got a minute left, I want to also say that this horrible plan that the city council looked at last week around this CEIP contracting equity something plan is another misguided plan that hides the fact that people of color are not getting their fair share of public contracts from the city, from City Hall. And the people who are responsible for oversight have consistently failed in their oversight of that system. And the mayor says he's bringing it back in August. I would encourage you to keep an eye on the city council agenda and let Mayor Wheeler know that just putting equity in a title of something doesn't mean equality for people of color. The outcomes remain the same after 30 years of progressive leadership. Not right, not fair, not just. I am Joanne Hardesty. See you in a few months. It's been my pleasure. Thank you, John. Listeners, have a great day. Bye.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and support from Street Roots for those who can't afford free speech. Street Roots creates income opportunities for people experiencing homelessness and poverty by producing a newspaper published weekly in Portland, Oregon, and other media that are catalysts for individual and social change online at streetroots.org. It's 8:59 and Press Watch is up next. This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Report from Kabul speech by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House in Portland. Zahair Wahab, a native of Afghanistan and director of graduate studies at the American University of Afghanistan, will present a critical analysis of the Afghani political, military, economic, and cultural situation. Again, that's Report from Kabul by Zahair Wahab on Wednesday, July 26th at 7 p.m. at the Multnomah Friends Meeting House, 4312 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
Good morning, this is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek